Start with 111.
I don't care.
Oh, yeah, that's Representative Thompson is yeah. here.
That's exactly right.
Welcome, everyone. It's the February 15th. Had to look and see. Meeting of the Senate Committee on Business, Transportation, and Economic Development.
February 16th.
I think everybody in the building is here all the time, so you probably know this, but this is our first day in the Senate of hearing House bills. We haven't really had a chance, I don't think, to look at these. So the intent today is just to try to get a public hearing on the bills we have. And we will meet again next week, and we will act on those that the committee feels a desire to act on. So we're going to start first with a public hearing on Senate Bill 4011. Representative, while you're coming up, Patrick, you want to give us an intro?
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 4011 comes to you from the House on a floor vote of 58-0. No revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact. The measure requires individuals convicted of driving while under the influence of intoxicants to submit proof that they have completed a required treatment program in order to have driving privileges reinstated. I'll let Representative Thompson do the rest.
Representative, how are you today?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I'm fine today. This is one of those bills that we like to do, on at least on the House side, which I'll call a simple bill that's a fix, and we'll come back later and do the whole thing. You've heard that story before?
Haven't ever heard that.
This is one of those. So, very simple, a little convoluted. For the record, I'm Jim Thompson, State Representative, House District 23, and this came out of our committee. In June of last year, DMV issued a notice to repeal its administrative rule specifying that persons convicted of DUII who are attempting to have their driver's licenses reinstated must show a certificate of completion of DHS-approved alcohol drug treatment. This repeal notice caught my attention and the attention of my co-chair on the Health Committee, Representative Greenlick, because it was dealing with issues that had already come before our committee. In examination of the issue, DMV conveyed to us that the statutory authority for that rule had been called into attention by their attorneys and Department of Justice. Since the whole arena of DUII is now entering the healthcare business under the addictions part of healthcare reform, we went to the co-chairs of the House Judiciary Committee, who co-signed a letter with us asking DMV to withdraw the repeal, and we would address the issue and find a solution during the interim. That's the simple part that gets more convoluted. To that end, the four co-chairs formed an informal working group of all the state agencies dealing with DUII, either from a health aspect or a judicial aspect. The group has had a number of very positive meetings. Agencies have gained a better understanding of each other's roles in the DUI issues, and they're all committed to having a series of recommendations for addressing DUII in the 2013 session. The issue, however, of the DMV authority to require a certificate of completion can't wait that long. Without specific authority, the courts can direct an individual to treatment, but the individual can immediately go to DMV and have their license reinstated. This bill will provide clear statutory authority for DMV to have an administrative rule requiring that those convicted of DUII show that they've completed treatment as a condition to DMV reinstating their driver's license. It will also provide DMV authority to grant exceptions for good cause and rule writing authority to specify what situations constitute good cause. The authority will sunset in October of 2013, and that's because the more sweeping DUII reorganization should be on board by then. Legislation in 2013 will address the larger underlying question of which agency or branch should be verifying completion of treatment and determine what method to use as a carrot stick to encourage people to complete the treatment they are ordered to do. So this is a stopgap measure that corrects a problem that is current, and we expect to wrap it up in another wider program in this interim for 2013 legislation. So there are people here that understand this a whole lot better than I do. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Anybody have questions for Representative Thompson? Seeing none, thank you very much. Well, let's
thank
go
you.
Back to work if you wish to. Amy.
Okay.
Chair Byron, members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation representing the DMV. Representative Thompson did an excellent job summarizing what the bill does and why it's necessary and how we got here. The reason that DMV was noticing to repeal the rule was, in fact, because of advice that the statutory authority for the rule was quite questionable. And when we were, the department was asked to suspend that repeal, we respected that request and put the repeal on hold to give time for the legislature in 2012 to address the problem as they see fit. And so the solution is House Bill 4011, which again grants clear statutory authority for DMV to require this proof of treatment certificate, gives DMV the authority to grant exceptions and to write rules describing in what circumstances those exceptions would be given, and sunsets the bill in January of 2014, allowing Representative Thompson's group to look at this from a policy perspective to decide how best to encourage people who have been convicted of DUII to complete drug and alcohol treatment. Regarding the rule, DMV already has drafted a rule and is circulating that among several stakeholders, the office, the Oregon Health Authority, Addictions and Mental Health Group, private treatment providers, the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII, and the judicial branch to get their perspective on the rule so we write it correctly the first time. So that will be in place again until the beginning of 2014. That's what I have.
Thank you. Any questions of Amy? Don't see any. Thank you very much. Is there anybody else who wishes to comment on House Bill 4011? Going once, twice. Closed on 4011, and we will open on 4045. 4043, excuse me. I know that you're talking about these.
Hi, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, go, Patrick.
Thank you. House Bill 4043 comes to you from the House, where it was moved out of the chamber 49-10. There's minimal fiscal, no revenue impact. The measure allows the Department of Transportation to reinstate a person's suspended driving privileges or right to apply for privileges or any identification card or right to apply for such a card under certain circumstances if the suspended offense was for failure to give required or correct information on application for a driver license, permit or identification card, or for a commission of false swearing on such an application. The measure has an operative date of January 1st, 2013, but has an emergency clause and would become law upon passage, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Patrick. Senator Olson, welcome to the best committee in the Senate.
Well, we'll discuss that later. I would like to defer to my constituent, Mr. Ryan Oliver.
Excuse me. Mr. Oliver, please.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Ryan Oliver from Canby, Oregon. And I want to thank the chairs and committee for taking the time. 4043, as you well know, or may not well know, is the use of the facial recognition on for identity theft on getting your driver's license. So in my real world scenario here, my wife, who 15 years ago, a college student, made a youthful mistake of getting a fake ID, and I'm sure she was the only one doing that at the time, got a fake ID, and 15 years later, went in to get a new license, and it turns out they started saving the photos in 1997, and then I can't remember what year, but they started using the facial recognition. So she got in trouble for the fake ID. So the turnabout on this is that, you know, it's a law that probably looked good on paper, but 15 years later, I'm not sure the punishment still fits the crime. In our situation, we can make it work. The problem with it is that you get a one-year suspension of your driver's license. So if you're 19, maybe that's fitting. If you're 20 years later and a parent with a family wage job, it becomes potentially an issue of now they may, you know, there's SR-22 that comes with that because your license is suspended. It's a hardship. So there's a possibility of losing your job. My wife was a driver for a company. Her company was nice enough to let her get the SR-22 and continue her job, but they very easily could have said thanks but no thanks because of that, because of the insurance stipulations, you're no longer welcome. And so that's kind of some of the real world effects of this law. Also with this, I think the intent of the law was to maybe get the people that are using this for the fake or for identity theft versus using it for fake ID. And the criminal code, ORS 165.8, they split the laws into two different ways. One is for people actually stealing IDs for identity theft, and one is for getting fake IDs. And then they rule accordingly. And this kind of brings the law in order with that to make it so if you were using it for alcohol purposes and not stealing identities, then you were basically get the lighter sentence and be able to show that you're not if you kept your nose clean, basically you'd be fined 15 years later. So that's kind of some of the real world effects on this. And I probably didn't sell it very well, but I sell insurance. I don't usually
lobby. Sell fake IDs.
Yeah, exactly right. That's why I'm over here and these guys are here. So so with that.
Ryan, you're not in a unique situation. I happen to have a constituent and a friend who is similar to your wife, did that. And 15 years later, she was a special needs teacher and driving around, and all of a sudden she didn't have a license, and literally it cost them close to $20,000 to litigate it and work a deal out.
Jesus Christ.
So, okay, well, nice to know we're not the only one, apparently.
But doesn't make it any better, does it?
No, but that's just it. I mean, for us, we can make it work. I have a lot of family in Canby, and so we can make it work because we can't drive. She can't drive with the kids. If you were a single parent, say, I don't know how it would work, because with the SR-22, this ordinance says you cannot have any family time, whereas with some of the hardships, it allows a little bit of family time, but with this one, apparently you cannot. We were denied that privilege. So for us, it's not the end-all, and I guess I also want to say that I'm not here to be, my wife got caught, now I want justice type of deal. I'm here to say this. Something doesn't. It just doesn't smell right with this deal. It's 15 years later, the indiscretion of a 19-year-old versus, it could have been. She went in because she lost her license. If it was a renewal, it would have been more of 20 years down the road, and this happening. And so it just, it's something that's not making a whole lot of sense with it.
Senator Durant?
Thank you. And this question is for Representative Kennemer. And Bill, you told me, and I can't remember why, but why can't we just change the statute of limitations on this?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, and Senator Girard, Bill Kennemer, State Representative, District 39. Part of the problem here, and I did confirm this today when I talked to Tom McClellan, the director of DMV, that they checked with the Attorney General, and this is a civil rather than a criminal matter. Therefore, the statute of limitations does not apply, and I'm expecting a document from the AG certifying that it has not arrived. I had hoped to have it by today's hearing. So that's the reason for this rather unusual request. And there are a lot of more interesting and articulate ways to do this, but by the time you deal with statute of limitations and you deal with the issues of fraud and you deal with due process and proportionality in the sentence, that's a three-year discussion in judiciary, frankly. And we have roughly 50 to 100 citizens who would fall into this category over about the next 8 to 10 years as the facial recognition moves through the entire protocol. So it seemed to me that this was, in fact, I thought this was a great one for our little session. this is sort of a technical fix. I think 14 years later, it's a bit tough to not even be able to, you know, care. Well, I just, it was amazing.
Okay. More?
What?
You have more?
Well, I didn't know what else. What else?
Brian did a pretty good job of describing the situation.
Mm-hmm.
Generally the bill, but I don't know. Senator Rosen just kind of tossed the ball across the table really fast, so I'm not sure.
That's right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Alan Olson, representing Senate District 20. Ryan is a constituent of mine, lives in the same town I do, and he brought this issue to my attention, and Representative Kenemer has well represented it. I would just like to point out in the bill itself, there is reference to 809-415, and in that 809-415, it deals with suspensions for conduct involving judgments, financial responsibility, and dishonesty. A little bit different than this, but in that statute, in that section, they allow you to get your license back if you can prove that it's been 7 years since this happened. Mm. So this is not groundbreaking law here. It's an opportunity to fix those things that many did when they were young, and allow them the opportunity to move on with their life and not be penalized for something that technology has brought forward. And I think we will find in the future that technology will open up many more venues to find things that people have done wrong, including DNA. Our new DNA testing has showed that we can go back and look and see that people are innocent from DNA testing. So as technology advances, we'll find that there will probably be more instances where we need to modify laws to take into account what has happened. So I'm here to support my constituent and support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you, gentlemen. Ryan, thanks for coming down.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I see why this is a good committee. Everybody's kind of nodding off a little bit. They're just nodding off.
They're riveted by your testimony.
Riveted. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you.
Do you want your bill to pass?
Amy?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation and DMV. The prior panel, again, did an excellent job summarizing the situation. Representative Kenemer brought this to DMV many months ago, and we worked in conjunction with him to come up with a solution that would work for these particular kinds of situations where a person has either submitted false documents or falsely sworn on their driver license or ID card application only for the reason of either buying alcohol or entering taverns in similar kinds of situations when they were under 21. So what folks will do is if they are caught in this situation, their license will be suspended, and then they can get a very quick, what's called an administrative review. DMV will have written rules with objective criteria to come up with, trying to pinpoint that a person likely did this, committed this act for the sake of alcohol. And if they can prove those, you know, two or three objective criteria, then they can get the suspension lifted. They won't have to do the SR-22 insurance, and they have a reinstated license.
What's the SR-22?
SR-22, Chair Beyer, is getting proof from your insurance carrier that you are insured and will continue to be insured going forward. Frequently, it's more costly than just a standard purchasing standard insurance. And then you show your SR-22 form to DMV proving that you are, in fact, insured.
So let me understand. The current law does not have any exception for administratively a DMV to say, yeah, you did this 20 years ago, but you've had a good, clean driving record, and we're not going to deny you your license.
Chair Beyer, the current statute is very restrictive. It says that DMV can, I should say may, suspend for the offense of submitting false documents or false swearing. And if DMV does suspend, it's a one-year suspension. So if DMV were to take the step of administratively making an exception, it's an all-or-nothing situation of making the decision that for any reason, whether it was this one or another one, that in DMV's judgment that it wasn't deserving of a one-year suspension, and then that would be it. You just simply wouldn't be suspended for having done that act.
So DMV has that authority to do that now?
Chair Beyer, DMV has the authority to not suspend for any reason involving the false application. So DMV could write a rule that said you are not suspended when you do X, Y, and Z. DMV did not write such a rule. That seems to be more in the purview of a legislative decision than an administrative one.
But I'm a little amazed because it seems like you have discretion if the legislature said you may suspend. It seems like the department would have the authority to hold a hearing and determine that, okay, yeah, you did this in the past, but you've had a good record since, and so we're not going to suspend. Am I hearing you say they don't have the authority to do that?
Chair Beyer, DMV does have the authority to write such a rule.
Let me ask a question maybe that would clarify.
Yeah.
Is this an issue that if a person is suspended, you have the ability to, you don't currently have the ability to reinstate the license while leaving the suspension on the record? Is that what the issue is? Or is
it? Chair Beyer and Mr. Brennan, that's true. That I don't think DMV does have that authority. But I think the issue here, Chair Beyer, is the only option DMV has is to say either you're suspended for a year or there's no punishment whatsoever or sanction whatsoever for having submitted false documents and falsely swearing. Mm-hmm. And so, I'm sorry.
Okay, so.
And so the bill from Representative Kenemer instructs that there are certain steps to go through to hold people accountable to some level, but that they can get the suspension lifted.
So can you, Senator, I'll get to you in just a second. But I'm trying to understand what the bill does, what new authority it gives you. And I don't see anything that's very descriptive about what would DMV do, other than you have authority to write rules, which I kind of think you have already.
Chair Beyer, the bill instructs DMV that it will create this system where the suspension will be lifted if certain circumstances occur. And in the bill, those circumstances at least are you were under 21 when you obtained this false identification, and that identification made you older than 21. Then beyond that, the bill gives DMV rule writing authority to come up with any other objective criteria to determine whether the sole reason for obtaining the fake ID was for the sake of alcohol.
Does it give you the authority to issue a fine of some amount?
Chair Beyer, no, it does not. The only monetary sanction is the $75 reinstatement fee. Mm-hmm. One factor there is that to create a new fine becomes, quite honestly, quite expensive for the DMV system and would put a big fiscal on this bill.
Okay. Senator Girard, then Senator Burdick.
Well, I think she and I are going to ask the same question, but the question it reverts back to Representative Kinnemer's comment that this is a civil crime, and I'm trying to figure out why that's
civil violation.
A civil violation. Okay. Thank you for the clarification. And not a crime. It's a civil violation and not a crime. Can you explain why that is? Because it seems to me like if we put a statute of limitations on this, that would be a better fix. But I don't want to foul up the works, but can you explain?
I was thinking that too, but sounds like we can't.
Well, Chair Beyer and Senator Girard, I wasn't party to the conversation that Representative Kenemer had with DMV Administrator McClellan. My understanding of DOJ's review of the statute of limitations question is there is no current statute of limitations on these suspensions. So it could have happened yesterday, or it could have happened 20 years ago. There's no time limitation currently. My understanding is that the legislature could legally place a time limitation on this type of violation, and that would be just as any other statute of limitations in the code would say, after X amount of time, this is no longer a suspension.
Senator Burge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So let me get this straight. If someone actually gets false ID and gets caught right there at the time, somebody catches them when they're using the fake ID, what is the penalty? Is that the civil penalty that you're talking about?
Chair Beyer and Senator Burdick, it would be the exact same situation as we've been describing, although in Mr. Oliver's situation, it was 15 years later. A person under this bill could be caught essentially immediately, and if they too could, and so today the sanction is the one-year suspension. Under the bill, if they could demonstrate the objective criteria that they were only obtaining the fake ID for the sake of buying alcohol, they too could get that suspension lifted.
Yeah, I'm very, very uncomfortable with kind of singling out buying alcohol and saying that, you know, you're putting that in a special category. Number one, I'm wondering how we got this bill. It seems like a judiciary bill almost.
We get all OLCC.
If we had a statute of limitations approach that was, for example, a statute of limitations that applies to this type of thing, and then if there is evidence that someone has used it for identity theft or for some other criminal purpose, then the statute is not in effect. The statute of limitation is not in effect. I'd feel much more comfortable with something like that, because I'm sure there are other situations where, you know, I mean, how are you going to prove that somebody wanted to buy alcohol 15 years later? It's not a very good spot to be in. So do you see anything wrong with that? I mean, obviously there's a difference between somebody who goes and gets a fake ID so that they can do identity theft and clean out somebody's bank account versus somebody who, which is a crime, versus somebody who gets it for the purpose of doing something that apparently is not a crime. I thought it was a crime to use false ID, but apparently it's not. So if you could kind of make that distinction, in other words, have the statute of limitations be the default, but it wouldn't apply in cases where a crime had been committed.
Senator, I think the difference, and correct me if I'm wrong here, is it may have been a crime if you got caught using false ID, but that's not the case that mostly we're talking about here. We're talking about someone who did it initially, and had they been caught, that would have been a crime and would have been treated that way. But this is 15 years later, they don't have it anymore, and they're just caught with someone saying, you did this before and this is different, and at some point in the past you had a false ID.
Chair Beyer.
Violation of the DMV stuff. Is that different?
Chair Beyer.
Let's just put a statute of limitations on it. I mean.
Okay. Yeah. Go ahead,
Amy. Chair Beyer and Senator Burdick, I believe that's right, Chair Beyer. So it is a criminal offense, a crime.
That's not what you said before, yeah.
I apologize if I misspoke, Senator Burdick. It is both. There's an administrative sanction, and there is a criminal, it's a crime. The crime has a statute of limitations. So when DMV catches somebody through whatever means that they have obtained a fake ID, there's the administrative sanction, and also DMV turns that information over to the appropriate law enforcement body.
That makes much more sense.
I apologize for not being clear.
Yeah. More questions?
There's a problem here. I think that was documented. I don't think somebody should go through what they went through 15 years after the fact. I did some things I'm not proud of when I was 18 years old. I don't know if any. Oh, how much say? You might. You, anyway, but the thing is, definitely don't want to go there. But the thing is that I think that there needs to be some type of statute or statute of limitations. But if you can't do that on a civil case, this was the fix. And so I think that, you know, they argued this back and forth, and I kind of think this is probably the way we have to go. But I'm with her that a statute of limitation is the obvious fix, but I don't know if you can do that in the civil manner that Representative Kinnamer said.
My gut level is, I mean, if I had my preference, it would just be, say, you have an opportunity to have a hearing, and after the hearing to decide whether a suspension was warranted.
Yeah, that could be.
Which I kind of thought that's what you said, you had that under the current statute, but... it'd be great. I mean, it would make sense if you still had the ability to issue a minor penalty, you know, 75 or 100, whatever. I think there's a reason to do that, but... Okay. Need more? We're not going to move it today. Time to think about that. Thank you, Amy. Anybody else wish to testify on House Bill 4043? Seeing none, we close on 4043, and we will open a public hearing on House Bill 4047. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 4047 comes from the House with a 60-0 vote. There's no fiscal revenue impact. This measure revises the authority of charitable organizations and nonprofit organizations to sell alcoholic beverages in factory sealed containers without a license, including sales by raffle. It allows such organizations to auction a raffle cider or limited amounts of distilled liquor, limits the duration of those raffles as well. The measure specifies origin and importation requirements for auctioned or raffled alcoholic beverages. There's an emergency clause, so this measure would take effect upon passage and signature by the governor, Mr. Chair.
I have to say, I didn't know they couldn't, because I think I've been at a number of charity events where this has been done. But Ms. Lang, how would you like to...
Good afternoon, Chair
Byer,
and members of the committee. My name is Ginny Lang, and I'm here as a member of the board of the Oregon State Capital Foundation, and in behalf of them as well. And the reason we're here is...
That would be the law-abiding Capital Foundation, apparently.
Ooh, the reason we're here is this.
Did you come bearing gifts?
No.
Sorry.
House Bill 4047 takes care of an issue that we found out sort of after the fact. Buffalo Trace, which is one of the oldest distilleries in the country and is located just outside of Louisville, Kentucky, put out a notice a number of months ago to nonprofits throughout the country that they could apply for one of 174 bottles of fine Kentucky bourbon from what is called the Millennium Barrel, the last barrel that came off the line at Buffalo Trace in the 20th century. And the barrel is represented in these 174 bottles. So after my husband was no longer a member of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, and in behalf of the Oregon State Capital Foundation, we applied to receive one of the 174 bottles and were indeed granted one of them, number 132, as a matter of fact. After it came into our possession, we realized that we couldn't do anything with it because it is not lawful in the state of Oregon for a nonprofit organization to raffle or auction or sell distilled spirits. So in order to make sure that we were going to be doing things in a correct manner, in the same way that beer and wine can be auctioned or raffled, Representative Berger, who is also a member of the Capital Foundation Board, and Senator Atkinson, also a member, volunteered to help work during the 2012 legislature to get this matter rectified. So House Bill 4047 does that. It allows a nonprofit organization on an annual basis to auction or raffle distilled spirits in behalf of their organization. This bill corrects the situation so that we can proceed to lawfully make a lot of money for the Oregon State Capital Foundation. And we have worked with both industry people and the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to make sure that there weren't any unintended consequences of doing this. So we would appreciate your support of this bill, and I can assure you that I would be back around to give all of you the opportunity to buy a lot of raffle tickets when we get ready to auction this bottle of bourbon. Happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
I got one.
Okay.
How old is that? It's 12 years old now, is that?
Yes.
What was the question?
How old is the whiskey?
12 years.
12 years.
Trust but verify.
See, the thing is, if you
trust
take a... See, my feeling is if we took a longer time, then the whiskey would be aged and it will have a higher value. So, you know, we might want to stall a little bit. But given the fact I like Ginny so well, I guess we'll have to go just with 12 years. You know.
Well, you can always buy it, hold on to it if we pass the law.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Well, I guess you can't buy it. You'd have to take a chance on winning it.
Gambling, booze, what a committee.
Thank you, Jenny.
Thank you.
And Mr. Kott? Drop it.
Senator, members of the committee, I wasn't prepared, of course, but I happened to find this committee in session. And since the subject is alcohol and distilleries,
sir, could I get your name for the record?
My name is Bertrand Kopp. I have a petition I'm putting before the governor. If the members of this committee or anybody else that wants to take the alcohol out of the gasoline would care to sign it and root it. I have a tape of an Oregon Field Guide story about the horrible problems they're having on the Columbia on their boats. Well, that's the same all over Oregon. And the blanket use of the alcohol addition to the all the citizens of Oregon was ill-considered because it should have been tried on a small scale like on the state motor vehicle department. Mm-hmm. And everywhere you go, you talk to people, they've had engines ruined, they had huge problems. And since there's no bill in this session that deals with that problem, the bill in the last sessions didn't pass. I'm asking there if any of you would like to sign this petition or look at this tape and consider adding your signature to the petition and sending it to the governor. Maybe we can get an executive order to take it out this session instead of making people hurt for another year.
Senator Jarrett?
Thank you for your testimony. That doesn't really have to do with what we're working on here, but just wait a second. I will have a bill next session to do that. I mean, well, I fully understand what you're saying, but that really has nothing to do with what we're talking about.
I understand this, but it's alcohol and distilleries. I thought I'd put my word is here. At any rate, I'm going to leave this and the tape here. Yeah. So in case any of you would like to view the tape or sign the signature, we get it through to the governor this week.
Thank
the House is also doing it.
I'd like to say that if you ever ran for office, you'd do well on the Ways and Means Committee.
I'm afraid I haven't got the patience. I'm sorry.
Thank you very much, sir. That is all I have signed up. OLCC, no comment. Representative, are you here on this one?
He's on the next one, Mr. Chair.
Next one, okay. We have nobody from the Lottery Commission that wants to take a shot at this one? Okay, we will close on House Bill 4047 and open a public hearing on House Bill 4092. Representative, come on down. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Senator. Some notes. See the videotape
remains here for you.
Sign
folks.
The petition while you're there.
Don't think I brought a pen with me, Chair Byer. Okay, so, Chair Byer, committee members, thank you very much for welcoming us. For the record, I am Chris Harker. I'm the representative from House District 34, Beaverton and unincorporated Washington County, Cedar Mill. We're all aware of the need to increase the employment opportunities in our state at this time and to make some changes which will help the business community do so. There are certainly limitations on what we can accomplish from our seats, but House Bill 4092 addresses a very real need of one sector of our economy, the craft distilleries. Oregon is home to 46 such distilleries located all over the state, and in fact nearly half of your Senate colleagues have one, at least one in their district. I happen to not have any in my district. In fact,
do you want to buy a
2011, pardon?
Do you want to buy a raffle ticket?
May do that, sir. May just do that. In 2011, these craft distilleries produced more than 300 different products in the state and generated $53 million in sales in our state. That was nearly 12% of all of the liquor sales in the state, and they are growing. They hope to develop into the type and size of employers and revenue generators similar to what the craft breweries and wineries are already in our state. And this bill is an opportunity for us to help them at no cost to the general fund. Here's the situation. Like breweries and wineries, the distilleries must be licensed to operate. They may have tasting rooms, and they may sell their products in those tasting rooms. Like breweries and wineries, the distilleries may have tasting events at other sites, but unlike the breweries and the wineries, the distilleries may not sell their products at those other events. House Bill 4092 is intended to level the playing field in that regard only. It establishes the conditions under which distilled spirits may be sold at special events. The language you have before you is supported by OLCC. I don't wish to put words in their mouth, but they are here to verify or change, and by the Oregon Distillers Guild, a representative of whom is here.
All right. Good afternoon, Chairman Byer, Vice Chairman Atkinson, members of the committee. My name is Eric Martin, and I am the president of the Oregon Distillers Guild. We are a nonprofit trade association that represents over 30 distilleries throughout the state of Oregon. And you know, I'd like to thank Chris Harker, or Representative Harker, for bringing this bill forward. And thank you for the opportunity to for allowing me to speak this afternoon in support of this bill. The Oregon Distillers Guild supports this bill because it opens up new marketing and sales opportunities for Oregon's craft distilleries. The intent of this bill is to help us achieve parity with our brethren in the winery and brewery industry. Currently, Oregon distilleries cannot sell their products directly to the consumer at industry trade events. However, wineries and breweries can sell their products at these trade events. As the law stands now, potential customers may only have a small sample of our products, and then we can only hope that the potential customer follows through with the sale at some at one of the agency stores some other date in the future. Oftentimes, by the time a potential customer arrives at the agency store, they've long since forgotten about their experience with our distillery's products. This bill helps revise the statutes to allow Oregon distilleries to make the sale right then and there when the potential customer is the most interested in the product, thus increasing the likelihood of future sales for Oregon businesses. As far as accounting for the state's portion of the revenue, with this bill, there will be an accounting mechanism already in place. We've worked with the commission to develop the language that helps ensure that the appropriate accounting is taken care of. Currently, distillers may apply for a retail endorsement to their license, which allows the sales of packaged goods at the state-designated prices at the distillery only. Then the distillery remits the markup back to the state, just like any one of the agency retail stores. This bill extends that endorsement to allow distilleries to sell the products at qualified special events and then remit the markup back to the state, just as they would
What's qualified?
A qualified special event is an event where the hosting party, the distillery, applies to the commission for approval to hold such an event via the permitting process. The commission is then aware of the event and can monitor the event for compliance. With that, there will also be built-in safety controls where, of course, you know, there'd be no sales from minors and no sales to visibly intoxicated persons or anyone else that would otherwise not be permitted to purchase alcohol. In sum, this bill ultimately increases revenue and opens up new opportunities for Oregon businesses, and it increases revenue for the state, all without raising taxes. With that, I ask for your support of this bill, and I thank you for your time this afternoon. If you have any questions of me, I'd be happy to answer them at this time.
Great, thank you. Tom?
Yeah, that's who I'd like to talk to.
I'm curious about the qualifying. I mean, how does the current rules or statutes react to, like, wine tastings and that sort of thing?
Chair Beyer for the record, and members of the committee for the record, I'm Tom Irwin, the Government Affairs Director for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. There are special event winery licenses that the wineries can get and special event brewery pub licenses that the brew pubs can get, and there are temporary sales licenses that almost all parties can get. So there are various avenues that one can approach if you don't have an annual license for those kinds of events.
So like if a Rotary Club is doing something like that, I'm just thinking of events that I've been to different places, you know, civic groups are doing this, they have to apply for a special license?
Chair Beyer, yes, certainly they would. If they were going to sell alcohol, they would have to do so. If it's just a, you know, like a week-long event or a day event or something like that. Well, I don't want to get too complicated. Yes, that's the right, that would probably be the easiest way to go.
Senator
Rod? My question is, how do we know that the state's going to get their, I mean, this is all tax, so how do we know that we're going to collect our money?
Chair Barr, Senator Girard, the craft distillers report to us everything that they sell so that they're required to collect the tax due on it from the in-state craft distillers, and the same would apply. All out-of-state distillers have to go through our warehouse so that money would be there as well. And it would be a little bit of a distinction between the two, and I was trying to avoid complication, and I didn't want to get too far down this road, but probably should tell you that the out-of-state distillers, if they want to participate in one of these events, they will have to go through one of our existing liquor agents to do so that we can capture those dollars.
Yeah. That's a very interesting question. Were you going more?
Oh, you can follow that if you want.
Different than beer and wine, we actually don't tax hard liquor. We mark it up. So
that's correct.
How would you do that?
How would you do?
I guess you just you got a standard markup that you apply. Is it? I assume it's not standard across all different types.
And I don't know the formula offhand.
So the assumption would be if Eric's distillery was going to sell a bourbon, for example, there's probably a standard markup, and you would apply that. In essence, it functions like a tax then.
That's absolutely correct, Chair Mayor.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Is that tax predicated on the value of what they say? Say that you had a Scotch and you had a Johnny Walker Red and a Johnny Walker Black, and are they going to be taxed at the same rate, even though they're different commodities and different values?
So, Chair Beyer, Senator Girard, this is an area that I am not totally familiar with, but I think there's a demarcation between. There's a price point, if you will, and there's a difference in the two formulas. So there's a low end and a higher end based on the not so much volume, but the price that's set by the distiller or the manufacturer in this case. And then my understanding, the average markup is about 106%, but it's an average. And I can get you more information if you like, Senator.
I'm just kind of curious because my idea of what this would do would be scotch bars and that sort of thing, so that you could try single malts and blends and whatever. And we have some companies that are going into that venue a little bit, and some of it's fairly high end. And so I was just kind of curious.
Chairman Beyer, I'd like to add, the state does set the prices for our products. You know, if I am selling a vodka, case in point, my distillery, we make and produce two types of vodka, and I sell my products to the state at $25 per bottle. I would then sell that bottle to the general public at $50. That is a 100% markup, 106%. It fluctuates, but it's essentially, the price doubles. And those prices are set by the state, and I couldn't go and offer my products at a lower price or a higher price. This bill has language written in it that specifically designates that the distilleries can only sell their products at the state designated prices, and then must remit that markup back to the state.
Okay. Control issue. Senator Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you clarify for me, any of you? Does the bill apply just to distilleries having special events, or things like nonprofits, Rotary clubs having special events serving?
Chairman Beyer, Senator Edwards, this bill only applies towards distilleries only. It's to allow us the ability to sell our products, our packaged products, directly to the consumers, much the same as wineries and breweries. Whether the Rotary Club, that would be a separate issue.
Okay, thank you. Okay, anything else? Guess not, gentlemen. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairman. I should just check one more time. So is there anybody else who wishes to testify? Okay, then we are closed on House Bill 4092. Patrick, is there anything else to come before the committee?
Oh, yeah, Mr. Chair.
Anything from the members? There is none. We are adjourned.